a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. Well, hi folks, this is Jack Spirko with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday, beginning with the oldest of them and going forward. There's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years, so sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. And today, folks, we are flashing back to August the 10th, 2011. This was originally episode 721 with Tom Kowitz on the last four U.S. government defaults. And I have to say that they're still the last four. We haven't had number five yet, but boy, do we seem to get close to it. At the time that I did this episode with Tom, I had been saying that our government had defaulted on the currency multiple times. And there were people that didn't quite believe me. And I was getting ready to do an episode and explain everything on it. And Tom was an avid listener to the show. And he reached out to me and said, "This is my thing. This is kind of like, not only is this a thing that I've done deep dive into, this is what made me." And what he meant by that is, this is the thing that was his red pill, was economics. And when he started pulling on that thread, this was really the first thing that he found. Like many people, you know, you end up going to A Creature from Jekyll Island, reading about the creation of the Federal Reserve and understanding the monetary system. But then most people go to, we got to get rid of the Federal Reserve. We got to get rid of it. Well, yeah, okay, but good luck with that. He kind of went on this quest of, and then what happened? And then what happened? And after that, then what happened? And kind of became a historian toward monetary policy from the advent of the Federal Reserve up to, at that time, 2011. And so he said, "Can I come on and why don't we talk about that together?" I said, "You need to come on the show for sure, bro. So come on." We got him on the show. Now, the way I initially got in touch with Tom, like I said, he was a DJ for WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans. Not really a DJ. He was a show host. They had a weekly show, him and another and a gal named Michelle Gordon. And the show is called The Baldy and the Blonde Show. Now, I had them on a flashback episode, I guess about a month and a half ago. And that's about how far out it was, you know, at this time. In having him back on the show. And when I had that flashback with the two of them, I said that I don't know what they're doing now, but they're not doing what they used to do anymore. And whenever I do a flashback episode, I kind of look up the old links and stuff. Well, even though last time I looked up the links and found that they were defunct and figured, well, they're not doing this anymore, I tried that again, and I clicked on the link in the old episode for the Baldy and the Blonde Show. Turns out they're back. Baldy and the Blonde are back as of October the 2nd, 2024. Tom Kowitz, Michelle Godden, WGSO 990 AM New Orleans, Wednesdays at 4 p.m., premiering October 2nd. So if you are in the New Orleans market, you might want to check these guys out, because it's amazing to me that they're back and at it again. The original show ran for 3 years, so this was from 2011. The original show ran from 2009 to 2012, and so what the heck they've been doing for the past 14 years, I do not know, okay? Or 12 years, right? 12 years. They've been not active in that capacity anyway, but apparently they are bringing it back. And that's really cool for me to see people have some longevity in their mission and still be around after this long. Anyway, what you'll hear Tom and I talk about today is going through the four primary defaults and some of the things that happened in between them. But the primary defaults were obviously 1913, the Federal Reserve Act, the 1933 confiscation of gold, the 1965 Coinage Act, the demonetized silver out of our coinage, and then the 1971 closing of the gold window by Nixon. Many of you know about all those events, and you know that they're bad and you're not happy about them, but you probably don't see them as defaults on the dollar. They were all defaults on the dollar. When you're done listening to this episode with me and Tom, I don't think you'll have any doubt about that. With that, let's go ahead and flash back. August the 10th, 2011, originally episode 721. And a quick reminder, tomorrow morning, if you're listening to this as it was published, Saturday the 21st, 9 a.m., what happens? TSP 24 tickets go on sale. They won't last long, so make sure in the Telegram group, that is kind of your final warning. All right, folks, as I said during the introduction segment, we're fortunate to have back one of my favorite guests to talk to. Half of the team of Baldy and the Blonde. Today we have Baldy, a.k.a. Tom Coetz, who with his cohort Baldy runs a radio show on conventional radio, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans on Wednesday evenings from 5 to 6. You'll want to check them out there. You'll want to check out their website as well, baldyandtheblonde.com. But I brought Tom back today because I've had a lot of questions when I've mentioned multiple defaults in the past, and that if we default in the future, there's some things we can learn by looking at what we did with currency defaults in the past. And I think a lot of you guys are like, really, we defaulted? Or you're asking me questions that maybe I have a hard time fully explaining. And this is Tom's baby. Tom got into kind of the activist side of radio and communications because of the shenanigans that the Federal Reserve commits, the scam that it is. So I brought him on to have a conversation with me about this, and hopefully we can all learn something and be a little bit better prepared for what's coming. So, Tom, welcome back to the Survival Podcast.
Oh, thank you, Jake. It's always a pleasure. I'm looking forward to a great interview. Thanks.
Cool. So, you know, before we even get into the main subject that we talked about, I just want to maybe let's chat a little bit about some things that have just kind of copacetically come up, I guess, that's not good for anybody except maybe for this interview. We had this whole debt ceiling, I called it political theater. You probably would concur with that. But the end result is they have this new deal and they lifted the debt ceiling. And to me, it doesn't look like they really did anything except waste our time for 6 months.
Yeah, and I think that's pretty obvious to everybody. They think that we're all stupid, and I guess a lot of the masses are. But a lot of us are onto these guys, and the problem was not the debt ceiling wasn't high enough, obviously. It was that the debt was too high, and they did nothing to address that. And so it's going to be, more of the same, more inflation, more borrowing, more spending. It's obviously, too, that there was no cuts. They kept using the word cut, and we all know they didn't cut anything, except they reduced the amount that the CBO projected the budgets would be, but those were all based on increases every year. So they just cut the amount they're going to increase. And even then, I don't believe they'll end up even cutting that when it's all said and done.
No.
They did as they need to.
Because they'll just have a great big argument and political theater debate next about the next budget cycle, and they'll do whatever they want then. And of course, coming out of this, they cut our credit rating from AAA to AA+. I really, frankly, don't care. I'm not surprised by it, but I kind of see that as more political theater. Or do you think that there's something more to that? I mean, I personally feel the dollar's doomed long term, but this change in the credit rating really seems to be pointless to me.
Well, if anything, it's what we need.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, what we need is less borrowing. And you have to understand, too, no matter how this plays out, we're in for a lot of pain. And I'd rather bring it on sooner than later. So I'm dealing with it and not my daughter's generation.
I completely agree with that. I was just saying, my issue with this downgrade to AA+ is it just doesn't matter to me because I don't think we deserve that.
I don't think our credit rating is, you know what I mean?
It should be lower, and it should have come sooner. But what I'm getting at is, I say that it's better if the interest rates do go up, if that's the only way that these guys will finally stop borrowing so much money, because they're not going to vote to borrow less money. It's going to have to be forced on them. And if the only way to force it on them is higher interest rates, as painful as it's going to be, then fine. Because you know what? People fear, this whole system crashes and we end up with a new financial system. And yeah, that is something to fear because it's going to be painful. But I got news for you. We need a new financial system. This one ain't working.
Yeah, I think it's kind of funny sometimes to me that the very people that lobby the most to change it fear the most the fact that it would actually fail, as they've been saying forever and asking for the change. My concern is that when they change it, we'll all get the shaft again. Let's kind of talk about some of the ways we've gotten the shaft in the past. I don't want to go back really into the 1800s, but I do want to mention before we go through your timeline here in the 1900s that in the 1800s we moved both to and away from gold several times. And each time it was the people that got screwed by manipulation of that currency. So I don't see that either way is a fix by itself. There has to be some controls. But coming up in the year of hell for the United States, I think as you called it on your notes, and I consider it as like double hell, because in 1913 we got two things at the same time, and they're the gifts that just keep on giving in a bad way. One was the income tax. And the other was the Federal Reserve Act, and I kind of think that the income tax was to pay for the Federal Reserve. But can you kind of just give people what actually happened in 1913?
Well, it was at the very end of 1913 that they voted on the Federal Reserve Act. It was like December 23rd or something. So we all say that it started in 1913. Actually, it wasn't implemented until, I guess, 1914. But it just... it was sold as a bill of goods, that this would finally centralize everything and protect the economy from these spikes, you know, these peaks and troughs, and calm things down. And of course, it was never meant to be for that. It was just sold that way. It was just for centralization of the money power. And all you have to do is look at the scorecard to see, over the last 98, 99 years, that indeed it hasn't done us, the people on the street, any good. It's been harmful the whole way. There was a depression in 1921, depression through all of the 1930s, and how many boom and bust cycles and deep recessions, and now the one we're going through might be the worst of all, and no one's holding the Fed to account. So what they did in 1913, they foisted on us a whole new system that was supposed to be, well, they were telling us was supposed to be good for us. It's been nothing of the sort. And you don't get the, who did you vote for last time that they had an election for the Fed governor and the Fed chair? You know what I mean?
I didn't vote for anybody in the Fed. I mean, we elect the president and the Congress, and they set whoever they want there. And I don't even see people like Bernanke is really... I see them as like the front men for the people in the background that make the decisions anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. My point is, though, you know, we have these guys in place that centrally plan this economy, and they sure don't plan it in our favor, but we have no say. We know what how important democracy is, but we have no say in the people who were making those decisions. And I guarantee you, we sure wouldn't be voting for the likes of these guys if we would wake up and see what the scorecard's telling us after only 10 decades of history.
You know, and I'll tell you what, it's I don't think people really get the fact that these guys kind of have a revolving door back and forth between serving on the Fed board and working for the Goldman Sachs. And they have this entire thing set up where they can just skim money. And every time these guys, you know, we call it printing money, but today it's basically typing in dollar amounts into a computer. But when you put new money into a system, the only way that money, if it's not backed by anything, gets value is to suck value from the money that's already there. And they just basically suck value out of the economy anytime they choose to turn the faucet on. And the higher you are in that elite layer, that banking layer, the more access and the cheaper access you have to money, and the lower you're down, the more you have to pay for your money. And the interest rate is not just what we pay for money, because the inflation curve is also a big part of our cost and what we pay for money. And I think that's why Ron Paul calls it the hidden tax.
Yeah, well, and in fact, remember, even Bernanke himself, Ron Paul got him to admit it, that inflation is a tax. He just didn't take it a step further and say, who causes the inflation? They stopped the conversation there, but he did say that that inflation is a tax on the people, and it's the ugliest and most insidious one of all, because people don't understand it.
Absolutely.
And, but when you have a system in place where somebody can just create money out of thin air, I mean, of course it's going to be abused. If you tomorrow could say, if somebody gave you the power of money creation tomorrow, and you say, okay, well, from now on, money's going to be jack notes, and I'm not going to release jack notes into the economy unless somebody borrows each and every one of them.
Correct.
Well, guess what? You control the world within, 48 hours?
Absolutely. And I've also created a system then where the whole world owes me, and that every dollar or jack note or peso or whatever you want to call it is a certificate for debt. And there, in effect, because of that, there is no money. There is only debt. And if everybody repaid their debt, there would be no money. We'd contract the currency down to nothing. And I've said that on the show many times, and I have people that severely doubt that. And I always try to point out that if you go to the Federal Reserve's website, they say that themselves. They don't hide this. It's not hidden.
Yes, but get this. It's even worse than that. Not only can you not pay off all debt because money would go to zero, the problem is you can't even pay it down, the debt that is, more than about 2%. Because just a small contraction of the money supply, we saw what happened in the last couple of years.
Correct.
And the money supply stagnated or contracted a little, it's Armageddon.
Yep.
And so to try to pay down the debt just a couple percent, you can't do it. And notice that we never have.
Well, and that, that's the big thing. And I've had one challenge to that when I've talked about this before, and that was during the Eisenhower administration, that there was a significant dip in the debt. And my counter to that is, if you look at the public debt and the private consumer debt at that time period, all we did was transfer the government's debt to the people, and then both of them started going up again at the same time. So that's when all the GIs came back, and everybody got a credit card, and everybody got easy loans, and that debt never really went away. It just moved from the public sector to the private sector, and again, then both of them just started growing, and it was just a transfer of burden.
Right, and it always has to grow, because remember, when they create new money with new debt, they only create enough money to pay back the principal, not the interest. So the interest has to be paid with newly created money. So that's why the money supply always has to be growing. But once you realize that money and debt are synonymous, they're the exact same thing, that means you're saying that the debt supply always has to be growing. And again, that's why I say I welcome a new system. But we have to educate ourselves, or we're going to end up completely getting screwed, because we've had several new financial systems in the 20th century alone, but they've been largely invisible to the people. But with each and every one of the new systems that comes along, and we'll talk about them, is the people have got the shaft, as you put it.
Correct.
If we educate ourselves, then we to know what's a dangerous system and what's a stable system, and we can shoot for a stable system, I'm all for it. I'm all for a one-world government if it's based on freedom of the people, personal liberties. I'm for a one-world currency if it's gold.
Yeah.
I don't care. But if they're going to put a one-world government on us that's tyrannical, and they're going to put a one-world currency on us that's fiat, forget about it. So we have to educate ourselves and know what's stable and good for us, and know what's dangerous for us.
Yeah, and I know people out there having a heart attack when you said one world government there, and I don't want them to take that the wrong way. I think you're just trying to make a point there.
Well, I was just making a point that if it's truly based on freedom of the individual, I don't care who my government is, because I don't even have one.
Correct. correct. So if it was actually a government that looked like our founders originally intended, I just don't think it's possible at a global level, because the bigger government gets, the more tyrannical it becomes.
Oh, no, and you're right. I was saying that just to make a point. Yeah, yeah. I wasn't actually advocating it.
I just want to, because I know I'm going to get comments if we don't clear that up. So let's talk about how great a job the Federal Reserve did. So they came in 1913. Like you said, they really didn't get on the job until 1914. Let's just say 1913, because it makes the numbers nice and easy and rounded off. Most people know about the Great Depression in 1929, but very few people know that it took them a whopping, 6 years to be in the middle, mired in the 1919, severe depression that the United States went in and recovered through that. But within 20 years, they managed to screw things up so bad that a country that had backed its dollar with gold, and had a $20, gold piece be an ounce of gold, and it was that way for a long, long time, all of a sudden, they had to, basically say the $20 bill and gold were no longer linked to each other, and then they took away everybody's gold, right?
Well, yeah, that's how the people really got screwed. They got fear-mongered into turning in their gold for paper. And I've never really talked to any old-timers about that, but I suspect that but they were sold a bill of goods, and they were all patriotic and thought it was the thing to do, because of course it was done under the Trading with the Enemies Act, and meaning that all of the American people became technically enemies of the state, because that's what FDR cited, was the Trading with the Enemies Act, and everybody had to sell their gold to the Federal Reserve, and then within a couple of days they jacked up the price and said, well, now we're going to sell the gold to foreigners for $35 an ounce or something.
Was it really? To me, they didn't even jack the price up. That was the price. The gold was worth about $32 to $34 an ounce comparatively in the relative currency strength of the U.S. dollar against foreign government money. The government takes the gold with the lock at 20, pays the people 20 in paper, and then just allows the market price to reset and then just dumps it. And just basically screws people. For every $20, everybody lost about 13 to 14 bucks of their wealth. And you got to think about the time this was, folks. You could actually go out and buy some stuff with $13 to $14 in 1933. You know, we could buy gas then for a quarter, and we still can today for a quarter, if it's the right kind of quarter. We'll get that in a bit. But I don't think people really understand that that was basically a government default. The government just said, we can no longer back the currency with gold, and just said, no way, we're not going to do it anymore.
Well, and I'm glad you said that, because that is exactly a government default. Because here the media is telling us, oh, we just avoided the first ever default by the federal government. First of all, we didn't avoid it. All they did was disguise it, because we're in the middle of a default, or mostly postponed it. But it wasn't even the first one. It was about, I haven't really counted them up, but it said we've had three or four. And that was the first blatant one. That they just said, well, you know what? I know that you could have gold or dollars equally exchangeable here before, but not anymore. Send us your gold, and you get to have this lovely paper. That's absolutely a default, because that's an admission by the federal government that they just no longer have enough gold to meet their demands. Because they also, remember, they abrogated the gold clauses in their own bond contracts. If that's not an outright default, I don't know what is.
I completely agree, and that's really what it was. It was, we can't pay the bills, so we'll just change the method by which the bills are paid. And then we ended up in the middle of a world war. We fought that war, and we came away known as the world leader in all possible ways by the rest of the world, and the gold was still in some way connected to the currency. We just changed the relationship of it. And then the United States decided to go out and sell the entire world a bill of goods, right? And that's, you know, these two words that people remember from school, but they can't quite remember what they were, Bretton Woods. Let's talk about that a bit.
Well, it was a conference started in 44 and I think finalized in 45. And essentially what that did was it made the dollar, the world's reserve currency, and also established that the dollar, and only the dollar, was convertible into gold. And kind of the precursor to the petrodollar. In other words, if you want oil, you better have a dollar, right? That's the only reason, really, that the world will take dollars. Back then, if you're going to have a reserve currency for the world, and it's going to be from one particular nation, then that nation's got to print up a whole lot of dollars and export them, a whole lot. Well, how do you get them to do that? Well, you make the rest of the world a system is set up such that they can't even get their hands on gold unless they have those dollars. And notice that after, in the just a few years after World War II, what did we have? $13 billion of dollars exported from here overseas, and then the Marshall Plan shortly after that, another $12 billion, like $25 billion over the course of just a few years, and it was sold to the people as rebuilding their countries or, you know, after the war or whatever. Really, all it was doing was we're just creating lots of dollars here, exporting them. And remember, the people that create that money, they get to collect interest, right? They get to collect interest on something they just created, which is, when it gets down to it, that's an infinite interest rate. Because what's the interest rate on zero? Because they got zero, they just created it out of thin air. They're getting an infinite interest rate, billions of dollars, exporting that. So they love the system because they're getting plenty rich. Foreigners love the system. They're getting all this aid. We know what the American people got. It's just that they didn't recognize they're getting screwed at the time.
Yeah, and what they basically did is they said, okay, if you want to buy gold and quite a few other things in the world, and it's still that way today, and some nations are starting to break that covenant, so to speak, and they really need to be doing it. I'd be doing it to prick myself as well. But people in the United States in 1945, if you or I, Tom, had been around back then and we said, you know what, I like to diversify my wealth and I'd like to go out and I'd like to buy myself 20 ounces of gold and put it away, we couldn't do it. But other nations, people could, and they had to use our money to buy their gold.
Well, I believe it was foreign central banks only. It wasn't okay. Individual.
Okay.
Okay. But they wanted gold.
Sure they did.
So they had to have dollars, and so you had this system set up just like the petrodollar today, where they exported the inflation of the United States. They sent it out overseas. We didn't feel the inflation in the terms of prices here at home because the money had been exported. But the people creating that money sure got rich because, remember, they're collecting interest. Because money doesn't get released into the economy unless it's borrowed, because money is debt. And I know a lot of people, they have trouble making that connection, but it's absolutely true. They don't just make money and then, like, give it to anybody, do they? No, they make money and they lend it out. They create it out of thin air. They collect that interest. And so they love these systems where they tell these foreigners, okay, you can buy gold. Sure, you can buy gold, but you're going to have dollars, and we'll be happy to lend them to the United States government, and then what they're going to do is they're going to ship it off to you, and we're going to call it foreign aid, or we're going to call it reparations, or we're going to call it rebuilding a country or whatever. But the bottom line is that the central bankers get unbelievably wealthy, and the American people get unbelievably screwed.
So, and I look at that 1945, and I think you do as well. It was a change in the currency, the status, but it wasn't really a default. It was a pilfering of the new currency created in 33. And that established that dollar as the world reserve. Before we get on to the coinage act of 65, I think I want maybe get your thoughts on this, because I think we are in danger of losing that reserve currency status. And the way we just described it, it sounds like a very, very bad thing. But in today's world, it gives us a major advantage in the world in trade. Because if you want to make an analogy for this, this is how I would put it. If we went to a barter system and we decided that the reserve barter commodity in the United States was going to be the orange, right? And that would mean that immediately California and Florida would have a tremendous advantage over the rest of the states because they're the two largest producers of oranges. So if Maine wanted to barter with Washington, lobsters for apples, for instance, because they're both known for that, they would have to do an exchange first into oranges and then use the oranges, and on the other side the same way. Washington would have to convert the apples into oranges, and then the oranges would go here and the apples would go there, and we sit in the middle, and as long as we're California or Florida, we have this tremendous advantage because we don't have to convert first. But if we lose that reserve status, that ceases to be the case, and we end up being like the rest of the world, and somebody or somebody's else gets that new status.
Well, here is the problem. When you are when you're the one with that status and you're riding fat and happy for a long time and you're king of the hill, that's all great. But when the day comes that you do lose that status, and it's hard for any one particular nation to be the world's reserve currency, because it's hard to have How do you produce enough dollars for the whole world to use? You can for a while, again, because you make them have dollars if they want to get gold, or you make them have dollars if they want to get oil. But at some point, that is a house of cards, and it will fall down. And what happens is when all those dollars that have been exported, because remember the Fed just in the last few years, it just came out that they printed $16 trillion, right? And they used it to bail out a lot of foreign banks and corporations. Well, now those dollars are offshore, just like all the petrodollars are offshore. But when we're no longer the world's reserve currency, you know, this big advantage that we've been having, sure, it's great. But when those dollars find their way home and come back to our shores, there's your $20, $30, $40 gallon of gas.
Yeah, there's your immediate devaluation by a minimum of 50% of the relative currency strength domestically as well. I want to put it this way, too, and I want to hear what you think about this. You know, we all remember the sitcoms from the 70s and 80s, and there was usually, you know, in any one of them, sooner or later, there'd be a bullying episode where, you know, one kid was bullying the other, and you kind of flash forward in time, and the one kid remembers the other kid as a big kid, but now one grew faster than the other, and the prior picked on is now the one that's stronger, and they're generally not real nice to the prior bully. And I think when we lose that, that's kind of like a simple lesson for us to realize that there's a lot of nations out there that we've been able to manipulate with this, and when we no longer have that power, they're not necessarily real happy with us. And I'm not talking about, you know, flat-out aggression, but, you know, it's just what's good for the goose is good for the gander type of thing.
Well, and you're right, because, you know, China has taken how many years with the turn of producing very cheap goods with very cheap labor. And they're not going to always want to be doing that, right? So you think they're going to care when it's our turn? They're going to welcome that.
And yeah, so, yeah. I kind of look at China, and I feel like they're turning Africa into what we made China. Like, they need a place for their cheap resources and cheap labor and somewhere to outsource their problems to and you know, be the developing hand within there and to extract from. And the last place in the world that's not really developed yet is kind of Africa. And they're trying to become what we were, not government-wise, but strength-wise financially in the 1950s.
No, I agree, but I'm afraid it won't just be Africa. I'm not saying it'll play out this way, but I'm saying it's possible that it will, that we are at risk from being that source.
You know, could be.
Because we would owe them so much, we can't pay them the money, as we mentioned. You can't pay the debt down. You can't do it. The debt supply, combined with public and private, as you pointed out, always has to be growing, because the money supply always has to be growing, and money and debt are the same thing. Well, we can't pay China back. They know that.
Of course.
So how are we going to pay it back? With labor? With real estate? I don't know, but, you know, you probably saw the story not so long ago. They're setting up an economic zone just south of Boise, Idaho. It's the only one I heard of, but then I saw a report where there might be several dozen around the country. Are you familiar with this?
Yeah, I'm very familiar with it. It's a real concern of mine, because these are not, you know, we talk about an economic development zone and we think of something the size of maybe a downtown metro area, but these things that they're setting up are self-sustaining communities that are designed in scope and theory anyway to roughly cover about 50 miles square. You're talking stuff like the King Ranch in Texas size stuff, which is actually, King Ranch is actually bigger, but I'm trying to get people's head around that. 50 mile square area is, you know, an entire metro area and suburbs, and they're buying kind of these areas that aren't developed yet and saying, we'll bring in development, we'll bring in jobs, but what they're also saying is, we'll bring a lot of Chinese in with us and set up 50 mile square islands of China inside the United States. And since they run their monopoly money off of our monopoly money, they can print more too and come in and buy up cheap while we're in the middle of recession and our land is depressed and the city governments and the local county governments they're strapped for cash. They're screwed. The municipal default, we'll probably save that for the end because I want to get through your timeline. I want to talk to you about that too because I think that's where the tidal wave breaks on us. But this is an answer, right? Here come the Chinese, and they'll be a tax base, and they'll buy this, and they'll give us all these Chinese dollars, and we'll turn them into American, and we'll fix everything. And that basically, when you are in a fire sale situation, the buyer is always predatory to me.
No, I agree. But there's another part of that equation that I also fear, and that is that we're going to have massive homelessness and and foreclosures here, and a lot of people hungry, and they're going to be begging to go be. They won't call themselves this, but that's what they're going to be. They're going to be begging to go be slave laborers in those economic development zones. Like I say, China is infamous for having slave labor. Why wouldn't we have it? That's my question, because when I bring up things like that, people kind of look at me funny, but my question is, why wouldn't that happen?
Well, I mean, and here's the thing. For years and years and years, we've said we want China to play ball and be democratic and get out of communism, get into capitalism. To me, when I look at it, when they play the capitalist game, they're pretty good at it. And there's over, 1.7 billion of them. And they've got, they don't care what they have to do to their own people to get where they want to be. They'll make sacrifices our people will frankly not make anymore. We did do things like they're doing now. We had plenty of people die over here building canals and building the first highways and building dams. They're doing that right now. We look at it and say how terrible it is, but that's how this country developed as well. I mean, we go back before the automobile and heavy train infiltration. The Erie Canal system, is what enabled the entire development of that area. They're doing those things now, and slave labor or what? And we used slave labor here. We imported it. So I think what you're saying makes perfect sense.
Yeah, and honestly, I really do fear that it's more likely than not, because typically what happens in a crisis is that the people who are the victims of the crisis are the ones that ask for the solution. It's not thrust on them. And our overlords will say, hey, that's a good idea. Yeah, come on in. We're not forcing you to do anything. You got your ass.
Yeah, how do you make a person go into a jail cell? Make it really miserable outside the jail cell, and they'll run in there.
Yeah, that's right. But, when you have people on the street hungry and they can't feed their families, but they realize, I could go in there and I could make widgets to send back to China. Now, they're not going to pay me except a little bit, but I got three hots in the cot for me and all my family. What would you do?
Yeah. Yeah. You got to, give people a choice between the streets and a warm bed, and even if the warm bed is not a good bed, it's still a warm bed.
And here's what goes at it. If that sounds drastic, it is drastic, but connect the dots, because the dots are there. The massive debt is there. The massive future homelessness is definitely going to be there. The economic development zones are there. China's history of having slave labor is all there. There's a precedent for all of it. Why would it not happen? I hope it doesn't, and it may not, but it certainly, absolutely could.
I would say that it'll probably look different than it does in China. It'll probably be put in a way that looks a little bit more palatable to the American mentality, but the result will be the same. Let's keep going on your timeline here, so I want to make sure we cover all this. That's what I promise, folks. So, 45, we get the Bretton Woods Agreement, the dollar's the reserve currency, we're fat and happy, and we had really kind of pushed the gold into the background of things, but we still had this real money in our pockets that clanged around and made a different sound than it does today. It was made out of this stuff called silver. And that happened, that worked right up till 1965, and then the government basically couldn't afford the coins anymore, so they just changed the rules again.
Yeah, and once again, the people got screwed. And they had a new system foisted on them. You had a new system in 13, and then a new system in 33, a new system in 45, then a new system in 64/65, but largely invisible to the people, right? Because they still kind of looked and operated the same, but it really was a whole new system. And what those systems have in common is that people get screwed more and more. And for a while, people they trusted that the new money really was like the old money. What's the difference? It's money. In fact, I can tell you this. I was born in 1960. And my parents paid for me in silver coins. I'm remembering the story correctly. It was like $300, and they paid for me all in silver coins.
Wow.
Now, that was right before the switchover, but I'm sure that when the switchover was made, that there were plenty of people, just like, okay, here's a quarter. What's the difference? But it didn't take so long, I imagine, for that bad money to drive out the good. In other words, you realize pretty quickly, wait a second, this, what I'm holding is really worth something, I'm going to hold on to it. So that a lot of the silver coins didn't disappear, but there was plenty of people who were victimized and spent their money trusting their government. And again, the story goes, the people get screwed.
Yeah, and I see that as a default, at least a partial default. It only, you know, in paper and coin, it only affected the coin side. But when your government goes from your quarter is a quarter of an ounce roughly of 90% silver, to your quarter is briefly there was some 40% coinage out there. Very quickly afterward, it's copper and some nickel and some cladding. One is worth actual real value and the other one is actually worth not a damn thing. That's a default. We can no longer make the money silver, so we'll make it copper and steel.
Yeah, that's absolutely a default. And so we were hearing how that we just avoided our first ever default. That's ridiculous. But the reason they have to do that, they don't get, first of all, the dummies reporting it are so stupid they probably never even heard of half of this stuff. But even if they heard of it, there's no way that they would even be allowed to discuss it. You know, you think they're going to say, oh, Fred, what are you talking about? We've had many defaults in the past. And, you know, he'd be off the air real quick. His mic would stop working, he'd be fired. That'd be that. So that's what most people don't know about is, one, because it's been, each transition has been largely invisible. The dollar bills still look about the same. The coins look about the same. They're still spent because, remember, they passed these legal tender laws that forced us to take them. That's why, you know. That's why we keep exchanging, because we have to. But most people, they don't see the transition, and they don't hear about the transition because the media and the government and the banking system sure isn't going to tell them. And so next thing you know, a few generations go by, and today's kids, they have no reason to believe that it's a good idea to attach the dollar to silver or gold, and in fact, what are they told? That it's bad. It would be a terrible idea. It would be a catastrophe. So it doesn't take very long, and not only is the real money gone, even the notion that we should have real money is gone.
Yeah, and I want to make a point for people about how big a default this really is and how it tracks through time. It used to be kind of cool because it almost, for like 50 years, the numbers were almost the same. Now it's about double. But in 1933, when all of this stuff happened with the gold confiscation, and silver was left in circulation, though, you would be able to go out with a one silver quarter and buy about 1 gallon of gasoline with it. And like I said, up until silver made a big bull run recently, all through the years, you go back to 1980, 1990, 2000, as gas moved up and down, which is one of our most volatile commodities that tracks against our dollar, it was at the point where if you had 64 or earlier quarter, the melt value of that quarter was almost identical to a gallon of gasoline. So basically, the silver stayed in checked inflation 100% against our most, you know, usable and volatile commodity for 50 to 60 years. Well, today, though, if you go and you take a silver quarter and you say, what's the melt value in it? I'm on coinflation.com. It's $6.93. So now that quarter would buy you about 2 gallons, a little less than 2 gallons of gasoline based on a national average today. So that quarter has doubled its spending power, and the government says that the one they gave you in 65 is just as good. I can't see how that's not a default.
Well, no, it's absolutely a default. And I like the way you talk, because, like me, you talk in the big picture with the broad brushstrokes, because you don't have to understand all the technical things behind the treasury auctions and the derivatives. I don't know about any of that stuff. I don't want to know about this stuff. But I know common sense. I know that when they say you can no longer exchange the paper for gold, and I know when they say, well, now the coins are going to be this junk instead of the silver, I know a default when I see one. It doesn't take a genius. I know when the people are getting screwed. I can see it. And I know the... I also know that if we do not pass this on to future generations, they're going to be completely bamboozled and mystified. They're going to be taken in by the lies, you know, by the media, by the banking system, by the government. So it really is our job, everybody out there who's hearing this, you need to just learn the basics and pass those basics on to your kids.
So let's talk about another, this is, I'm going to say, is also a full default to me. 1968, even after we got rid of the coins, even though you couldn't exchange your dollars for gold, We had our, you know, I remember having some of these as a kid. They're still in my strong box today because my grandmother said they're worth something as a collectible now. But they were called silver certificates, and you could get a dollar, and you could go get a dollar's worth of silver with a $1 bill. And in 1968, they said what?
They said no more. They just like they did with the gold. You know, again, another default, but again, also a largely hidden default. Almost nobody knew at the time that it was a default because the money that was out there circulating, the dollars that were not silver certificates, they looked a lot like the silver certificates, right? And they just, like converting the junk coins, I mean, the good coins to the junk coins, they just converted the silver certificate and they made it and it converted into this thing that looked like one but wasn't convertible to anything. But life went on and nobody realized that once again they had been robbed blind.
And to me,
another default in just a few years after Bretton Woods, you're running into a few defaults.
Correct. And to me, 68 was so much worse than 65. In 65, at least I could go out and I could, you know, be the implement of Gresham's law. I could go out and I could hoard the silver. I could go out and I could take as many silver coins as I could get. In 1965, if I had realized what happened, I could go down to the bank with a great big stack of 20s and buy quarters and rolls, and most of them would have came back to me in silver. I could have bought 50-cent pieces. I could have bought dollars, dollar for dollar, quarter for quarter. In 68, they took the paper that was supposed to be redeemable for the silver. So if I hoarded that paper, I got nothing. So in 65, I could work the system if I understood it, though very few people did. In 68, it was a lot more like 33. There's no way out of it. They weren't going to put me in jail this time because all they did was change what my paper was worth instead of take away my gold. But it's a flat-out full default.
It is. But you know what? You said something very important, and I'm glad you did. You said that if you knew, if you understood the system, you could have worked the system. And that's my point. There is a new financial system coming upon us, whether it's a new currency or just a flat-out devaluation where they chop two zeros off of this currency, whatever's common, it's coming. And we have to understand it enough to know how to make the new system beneficial to us, because that's our only hope. Because what's happened is with all these defaults and all these new systems, and again, there's been several of them since 1913, there is another one coming, and we have a chance, but only if we understand the evils of what they've been doing to us and understand the importance of having real money with real intrinsic value. If we don't understand that, then we've really completely screwed the next generation. So I would just implore your listeners, when you go to read about this stuff, don't worry about all the technical stuff. Who cares? If this system is so rotten and so fraudulent, once you see that, you have to keep studying to know that it's no good for us and to see what we need to avoid the next time. Because there is a next time coming, and soon.
Yeah, I agree. And moving on, though, with how things progressed, you know, you'd think maybe it'd be a long time from 1968 forward till there'd be some major currency change going on, but it took a year, and in 1969, the International Monetary Fund created something called an SDR, which I would imagine that probably 98% of the people out there right now have no idea what an SDR is, so why don't you tell them?
Well, that stands for Special Drawing Right. And the reason that they did that was because, and this is what I mentioned before, it's difficult to have a currency that works for the entire world when that currency originates from just one particular country. How does that one country produce enough dollars for the entire world? And that was becoming a problem in the late 60s. And so the IMF created the Special Drawing Right, and they specifically set as their goal to make it the world's reserve currency. They did that a long time ago. It's nothing new, because we've heard even Geithner talk about how the dollar might have to give up its status. We've heard Chinese officials say it, Russian officials say it all recently. But guess what? 40 years ago, they were already talking about it. Because it all comes down to it's difficult for one country to supply the world. So yeah, they created this special drawing right, but they don't really use it. It's not really a currency. It's like an, it's, It's used only between governments and central banks. It's not really a currency, but there has been talk of recently been talked that it would become a currency. But again, it's just fiat based on nothing, on vapor. And that's the importance of educating ourselves and future generations why we need to avoid this stuff. Anything that's fiat based on nothing, if it's paper, forget about it, no matter what they call it.
Yeah, and of course, since the dollar was still coveted at this time, once these SDRs were issued and people could basically create more of their own money by exchanging with other nations, they could then borrow more dollars, and that created a lot more dollars, which was the goal of this in the first place. These SDRs, like you said, they're not really a currency, they're like an illusion of a currency and designed to keep up the circulation of the dollar, the printing of the dollar. So even though we went off the traditional gold standard in 1933, there was still a gold reserve requirement, I guess is the best way I can describe it, with the dollar, where you couldn't just print as many dollars as you want. There had to be a percentage of gold behind them. But when this thing took off and the inflation came and it wasn't really being done anymore, we had two whopping years from this change, and then 1971 comes, and that's the big year that what happens?
That's when all hell broke loose, that because particularly France was saying, they were seeing was something they didn't like with the dollar. So they were bringing in, they're sending back a lot of dollars and exchanging for gold. Just like you talked about, like if you were a kid in 65 and you knew what was coming up, you'd trade all that paper for silver. Well, that's what De Gaulle was doing. He said, you know what, I kind of like what I'm seeing. You can have your paper. I want the gold. That caught on more and more and more. And all of a sudden, Nixon realized, we're screwed. It's not that we don't have the gold, it's that there's too many dollars out there. Right? So on August 15th, 1971, I think it was a Sunday evening, he goes on TV and he announced, no more. Now the Bretton Woods Agreement, remember, established that the dollar was the only currency that could be exchanged for gold. But he just went on TV and unilaterally declared, no more. We're no longer allowing foreign central banks to send us dollars and we send them gold. He just shut that window. But also on that day, he announced that that was when he announced his wage and price freezes. And that's what Americans heard. They heard that part. They're like, oh, great. Hey, and he fixed it. He waved a wand and said, prices can't go up. So when he opened his mouth that day, he said a horrible, horribly dangerous thing. And that is, or he admitted to a horribly dangerous thing, and that is that we can't send you this gold anymore. We're not enough gold. We printed too many dollars. But people didn't hear the horribly dangerous thing. They heard the good thing. Oh, hey, look, he fixed the prices, honey. We don't have to worry about it anymore. Well, that only lasted a few days, and it all crashed and burned anyway.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the way people we need to, real quick before you go on, I think people need to understand about that. In 33, 68, 69, or 33, 65, 68, the government defaulted, period, but mostly defaulted to the people of our own nation. In 71, the government, our government, that has this AAA credit rating that's been down to AA+, defaulted to the world. Told all the world that was holding these reserve gold dollars, hey, guess what? They're not reserve gold dollars anymore. We'll give you dollars for your dollars now.
Yeah, and it was just a short time after that was they said the petrodollar, where you had to have dollars to buy oil. So what they once had for gold, now they had in place for oil. But there's one good thing that came out of August 15th, 1971, was that's the day that Ron Paul has cited that when he saw Nixon give that talk on TV, he knew he had to go into politics.
That's definitely a good thing.
He's our only hope, or his message. It's our only hope, and I do believe that that's why he's largely, by the media and his own government, he's ignored and he's marginalized and he's scoffed at because they want the status quo. They need the status quo. The status quo is their power, and he's got the right message. It's sound money. It's a simple message, and the reason that most people, I suppose, don't really understand that too is it seems intimidating to learn about money, such a mysterious thing, It's not. It's a simple thing. And the other thing is, people think, well, what do you mean money? It's just money. I mean, I just go to the store. You know, I work and get my money. I go to the store. It's just money. They don't realize that what they're spending is not truly money, because it's not truly worth anything, and that we've been truly screwed since 1913. And so I keep coming back to this. If we don't know the dangers of a fiat system, and we accept another one, we are so completely screwed, because every time we switch to a new system, and remember, we've had many since 1913, every time we switch to a new system, what it has in common is that we just get screwed more and more. And if, we need to be ashamed of ourselves if we allow that to happen to our kids' generation.
Yeah, I actually think that we'll probably go to a gold system in the future, but I still think we're going to get screwed. Because what they'll do is they'll base the new dollar on gold, and you know, you'll still have, if you have $100,000 in the bank today, after this is done, you'll still have $100,000 in the bank tomorrow, but the dollar, you know, the gold price in dollars will go up to $5,000 or something like that, or maybe $10,000. And that just destroys our buying power in the world. It's a huge immediate inflationary spike that you don't see in the relative currency strength domestically, but eventually, since we're such an import economy, it'll come in really quick like a flood. And that leads me to a date you don't have on here, which I don't blame you for, because it's not what I asked you for, but I think one of the most important dates out there to see what the effect of this is, like a delay effect and the result, is 1975. In 1975, everybody looks at the gold window of 71, and a lot of times I'll mention 75 and people don't get why. 75 was when the American people were told, you want to buy gold? Go ahead. And look at what happened to the price of gold in 1975.
Yeah, look at by the end of the 70s, it was what, 850 or something?
Correct.
It was out of control. I mean, how can you do that in just a few short years? How do people not even... you never hear conversations about that. How can that be?
Yeah.
In other words, people take no interest in something like that, because I guess they think money's for the economists, and it's just too complicated for us mere mortals. But if we would just, and I'm glad you brought that up, if we just looked at that one example, that in just a few short years, it shot up from what, like $35 to $850 an ounce? Excuse me?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, because of the manipulation, if you look at the world price in dollars for gold in 1933 was about $33. It just worked out that way. By 1971, it was about $34, $35. And it moved around in and around that range. So it was relatively stable right up until 75, when people were now allowed in the mass market to spend dollars on gold. And to me, it didn't really change the price of gold. It showed the value. It was like a magician does a trick for you 100 times and pulls a rabbit out of the hat. And this was, when the gold came back in, it was just like somebody reached under the table, pulled the hidden mirror out that looked like you could look through, and you see the rabbit going through the tube, and the reality was made evident to people, but most people just didn't care because they were in the middle of a massive recession. 1970 through the 1980s, the whole damn decade was lost. And that was a big part of it, but people were more worried about, you know, the talking head on TV, much like today, or how am I going to pay the bills this week? And the average person wasn't buying gold at the time. It was the affluent class that said, I better do this. And of course, it went to 800 because there was an overreaction. But it never went anywhere near going back down to $35 again. Wow. Eventually it leveled in the $200 to $300 range, and that showed that basically over these years where the wool was pulled over our eyes, your $300 became worth $35 in reverse. It showed all the inflation.
Well, now the only hope we have really is that this is going to be a little bit different. And I do agree that there's going to gold or whatever. It's what I said early on in this conversation, was that no matter what we do, we're in for some serious pain. No matter which way we got out of this, there is no way out without serious pain. But I do believe if we go to something that's gold-backed or gold itself or just anything with intrinsic value, the difference is we need to make it serve as our money. Whereas in the 70s, they made it legal to buy it, but it wasn't money. And so, yeah, if we can somehow enter a system where gold is our money again, yeah, there's going to be hell to pay for the first, I don't know, few years of that. But there's got to be help to pay no matter what. And then hopefully on the back end, we hold on to that system. But, you know, we're up against some very powerful people with some very powerful interests. Again, it comes down to if you could create money out of thin air and release it into the economy only if somebody agreed to borrow it and pay you interest, you would control everything really fast. And that is what we're up against.
Yeah, I agree. My problem is I think that what they'll do, see, as long as you're setting the weights and measures against the paper that gets traded, you can still do anything you want. And that's, I think, how this reverse play is going to get made. And, I mean, I tell people, make sure you have some gold and silver holdings. That's the only thing I know to do if that prediction comes true, because I can't see how you're not going to lose if you're holding paper. Or, frankly, anything denominated in U.S. dollars, if you're holding stock, if you're holding bond, it doesn't matter. If it's a dollar-based asset, when the dollar collapses, the asset has to collapse too. Even if, like in the past, you didn't see the collapse right away or you didn't feel the collapse right away, eventually when we pull the mirror away and reality sets in and we have an import-based economy, you're going to feel it. So do you have any other way? I mean, I'm with you on staying on top of this and trying to have some impact on it. But when the change comes, and I think it has to, what do you think people should be doing to protect themselves?
Well, no, I agree. Anything paper, forget about it. I mean, we've seen that, like you mentioned, with the silver certificates, right? And the gold, when you couldn't get it with your paper anymore. The paper all of a sudden, literally overnight, they can just say, well, no, we're not taking that. Or, oh, we forgot to say, we just chopped off 2 zeros. So, yes, get out of paper. And I would think that the best way to go, now, I'm no expert on this, but I just know the big picture. And the big picture is that you need to have something of intrinsic value, whether that thing is long-term food or a water filtration system, the ability to grow food, including indoors, dried pasta, beans, or whatever that are going to last you 15, 20 years, knowledge of how to fix things, a good set of tools, you know, things that in previous generations you literally could not live without, you know. And if this sounds extreme, well, it's not really, because all it takes is just, it could be any number of reasons why the trucks no longer run to Walmart. You know, what if diesel gas is hitting $20 a gallon and the trucks shut down? Now what you gonna do?
Yeah, well, it doesn't sound extreme at all to this audience, Tom. I mean, you're in your home court here, so to speak. And I mean, that's why I think that, like, the two best plays I see for people right now, for this from a pure financial standpoint, are paid for productive real estate. I don't mean productive because you're renting it to somebody. I mean productive in your own life, and gold or silver as commodities. And I think if you do either one solely, it's all the eggs in one basket, so to speak. And if enough people do something in a certain way that protects them, the powers that be will actually pull a runaround on us and do it another way. So I think we have to be prepared by, you know, dividing up these assets into productive things. Like you said, skills, food production, land, all of these things have to be. And I know some people are out there thinking right now, dude, I only have so much money. And I think, well, that means you have to be creative. And you have to do as much of it as you can with what you have.
Yeah, or learn an important trade. You know, maybe you learn how to put in a hand pump for subdivisions where people are on a well. That describes me. I'm in a subdivision outside of New Orleans. Believe it or not, they're building new houses, even new construction, still on well and septic. Well, when the power grid goes down, people are going to need hand pumps, okay? So maybe I learn how to do that. That's just one example. Maybe I don't have money, but I learned a skill that I had never even thought of before. So be creative and be thoughtful, but there's another thing you got to be prepared to do. And I'm not advocating it, because I would never advocate anybody breaking the law. But what happens when they criminalize holding silver and gold and hoarding food? Because, you know, in 1933, when FDR made everybody sell their gold to the Federal Reserve, He did it again under the Trading with the Enemy Act, and he used the term hoarding. You cannot hoard gold. Well, what if you just wanted to, like, have it for a little while? They didn't care about that. They accused everybody. If you even had it, they accused you of hoarding it. That's why you had to turn in. What happens when they say, oh, nobody is allowed to have more than 50 pounds of rice? And if that sounds crazy, well, they've confiscated the gold before. Why wouldn't they do it with food? And so I would say, and I'm not advocating it, that if you are planning on long-term food storage and extra ammunition and extra gold and extra silver, you better be prepared to break the law at some point, because a lot of people are not going to want to turn their stuff in. So you better be prepared to be a felon. As sad as that sounds.
No, I think if we get to that point, then I think it's, you know, right now I'm not advocating a breaking the law either, but I think if we get to that point, I do. I think it's incumbent upon us as a people at that point to say, to hear thou hast come and no further. And I think that line in the sand for me happened a long time ago, but I think there's a point where the American people have to collectively do this. And FDR did a lot of crap like that. There was I don't remember the exact case, but there was a farmer that wanted to grow wheat or not sell his wheat was the thing. He didn't want to sell his wheat. He wanted to grow it and use it for his own livestock. And they said, you have to sell your wheat, and then if you want some for your livestock, you have to buy it back. And he said, and that was part of this stuff being done at the federal level, and he said, no, I'm in this state, I don't remember what, I think it was Indiana or something like that, and I'm not selling it inside or outside of Indiana because it's not being sold at all, so it doesn't, you know, federal commerce does not apply, it's not in between the states, so go away. And he lost that case at the Supreme Court.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. They you know what they said? They said because by not selling it, you are impacting interstate commerce by not selling it.
Yeah.
Impacting everybody else. So they will do anything. They will call people an enemy of the state, like FDR did. They'll say that you're impacting interstate commerce by not selling yourself. They'll do anything to reach the means that they want. It's absolutely thuggish and criminal, but they've done it before. And get this, FDR's hailed as a hero.
Correct.
You know, when you look at,
he's considered one of our greatest presidents of all time.
Always listed as like the number two or number three greatest president of all time, and look what he did. And so, I mean, does anybody really think that the current president is not capable of doing that kind of stuff?
In fact, I'll tell you this on FDR. I believe that there are more people today who are Democrats because of FDR than any other reason. And the way it works is your granddaddy was a Democrat because of FDR, so your daddy was, so you are. And people come up with, and they don't even really know why, they gravitate to one party or the other, and this is not sticking up for the Republicans, because I have my own axe to grind with both sides of them. I'm just saying that most of the people today that are Democrats aren't Democrats because they woke up one day and said, well, what am I? They're Democrats or Republicans because they came up in a household with a predisposition that way, and the large predisposition, the absolute monopoly on the Congress for decades by the Democratic Party, to me, all goes back to FDR, who did more to damage this nation than any other president we've ever had, as far as I'm concerned, anyway.
Now, I agree. Now, here's where it gets interesting, though, is look when they passed the amendment, I forget even which number it was, but the one that term-limited presidents to two terms. They passed that right on the heels of FDR, and that was the Democratic Congress.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Are we to believe that he was really that popular at the time? He's being hailed, well, my point was, he's being hailed as a hero now.
Correct.
Right? But then I don't think that loved him so much because they term limited presidents right after that, and it was a Democratic Congress who did it. Now, but what I fear is that when the current president is going to say that there's a national emergency, he's got a lot of people who are going to, they're going to be the eyes and ears. Oh, children at school, they'll ask the kids, do your mommy and daddy have too much food in their pantry? Make sure you tell your teacher. That's not fair. You know, that's why Sally down the street doesn't have enough food, because your parents are hoarding food. You know, that's where I'm afraid we're headed.
You know, and I think it's important at this time that I make a really clear distinction between what is and what is not hoarding. When you go out during a time where everything's available and you use a surplus to put up reserves for yourself, That is not hoarding. Hoarding is what happens when nobody does this in the first place, and then a hurricane or some other type of emergency comes in, and people run out, and it's going to be a three-day emergency. We pretty much know that. We can look at the timeline of the ice storm or whatever, and people buy 6 weeks' worth of crap all at once and surge the market. That's hoarding, but the government turns around and points to the people that actually do the most to suppress hoarding and calls us hoarders.
Yes, of course, and turn you into a felon. You know, it's more than, it's one thing to do it to gold. It's another thing to do it to food and
the
ammo.
Food,
and again, so much precedent. I just don't see why he wouldn't do it.
Yeah, well, and here's the big thing I caution people with, though. When anybody looks at Obama, and trust me, I am no fan, and says, well, with this president, we could. It's important that you understand that that statement in itself is dangerous, because with any president, we could. And any president probably will, given the right circumstances. The reason that the Constitution exists wasn't to establish the offices of the president and the Congress. That's kind of its secondary goal. The basic reason that we had a Constitution was to limit what those people could freaking do. And to put checks and balances on each other. You look at FDR, you brought him up. One of the things about him that, I mean, alone should just make him a disgrace is when he wasn't getting decisions he wanted out of the Supreme Court, he threatened to appoint more judges. I don't know what gave anybody the authority to do that. Today we have we can't get a judge through Congress over, piddly things that's just not even a Supreme Court justice, just a district judge or something, just a district federal judge. And this guy says, you know what? Okay, we can have 9 justices, and then the Supreme Court starts yielding and giving him his way. So anybody that thinks we can't go down these paths just needs to take a look at history. You know, you can go back to around 1920, somewhere in there. Woodrow Wilson rounded people up and put them in camps. We weren't even at war.
Yeah, I'm glad you did. You reminded me. Because I should have made that point myself. It's not just this president. Because we put so much power into the hands of Washington or allow them to steal the power. We haven't given it to them. They just seized it. And it's just we just come to accept it. That it comes down to we need to educate future generations so they don't continue to accept it, because it's just become a way of life. Oh, the president said we have to do something, or Washington voted on this, or the Supreme Court said that. And they don't even care what the Constitution says. And remember, most people, most congressmen, have no idea what's in the Constitution. Most citizens probably don't know what's in the Constitution. And so when they pull these things, people don't even know that it's illegal and that their rights are being stolen from them. They don't see the dangers. And so, yeah, what happens is, okay, maybe you're a Republican now and you can't believe what Obama's doing, but guess what? You love your Republican presidents to have all so much power, so why are you so shocked when this guy is doing stuff you don't like? And the Democrats shouldn't be shocked when the next Republican comes in and does stuff they don't like. What we need to do is bring the power back, so they got to stop doing all this stuff that's dangerous to the people. And, you know, Ron Paul has said that. Somebody says, they asked him, what do you do first thing in office? He goes, well, the first thing I do is I'd take a cut and take it, so I wouldn't have that much to do.
Yeah.
He presides, that's why he calls the president, he presides over the government,
yeah.
Not society.
Correct.
And we have, the people, we've ceded society to Washington, D.C. How can we do that?
It mystifies me, but I think you brought up something very important, and it's important that everybody out there, you be educating your children to true American history, to true constitutional history, and don't think they won't be interested. If you bring it to their level, they will. And I think this will probably send a slice of terror through any government bureaucrat out there today or politician, if everybody would do this. The two most important things you need to teach your children today about the Constitution are the two amendments that no one almost ever talks about, and that would be the 9th and the 10th amendments of the Constitution, because they were the ones that basically said, if we didn't say the people can't do something, doesn't mean, or if we didn't give the people a right, it doesn't mean they don't have the right. These are just the things we're making sure you don't screw with. And then the 10th Amendment was, just in case you didn't understand, right? If we don't give you a power here, you don't have it. It goes to the states and then down to the people.
Yes. But you know what? If you even talk about the 10th Amendment, you're a right-wing extremist.
You're a racist. You're racist, too. Don't forget that. It's racist to believe that the individual is sovereign, which I find absolutely completely asinine, because the individual having sovereignty, and I'm not talking about this, you know, I don't have to play by the rules sovereign citizen movement. I'm talking about the sovereignty of our nation lies in the individual. The individual has the greatest power. The individual chooses what power to hand over to a local government, to a state government, and to a federal government, with the greatest power supposed to exist closest to the person. Now, how that can be twisted to it being extremist or being racist, I don't know, but I don't know if you've ever seen Interview with a Zombie. From
I love Interview with a Zombie.
Isn't it? I'm going to have to put that in today's show notes. It's one of the greatest things in the world. I can't remember the author's name, but he's like talking about his book, and the zombie just points at it and is like, racism.
That's Tom Woods.
That's it.
And I think he's even set up a website, interviewwithazombie.com.
Correct.
Tom Woods is brilliant.
Absolutely, and that's how things get played. I think we're kind of wrapping up the end of the hour here, man, it was a great interview having you on to talk about all this stuff. I hope people have a better understanding of it now. You got any final thoughts for, you know, what people should be doing? I mean, I think you and I are in agreement that I can't tell you when, but this thing is going to fall. And
yeah,
when, what do we do between now and then, and what do we do immediately afterward?
Well, again, you can speak to that a lot better than I can. That's absolutely your baby, as far as preparing for this stuff. But primarily, food that will last a long time. Silver, gold's just too expensive, but you can always get some junk silver. Because you're going to be needing that to trade with, and they'll probably make it illegal, but you're going to have to be prepared to trade with that. And a good set of tools, a good set of skills, but also... I really do think, and I've been saying this for a long time, and it's really starting, I believe, to play out, and that is that money and an understanding of what money really is, not these ridiculous Federal Reserve notes, but real money, what real money is, if you understand that, well, I should say if you don't understand that, there's really not much hope for society. Society in general doesn't understand it and demand a return to sound money, because you know if you leave this system in place that we have, you will never cure any of our woes with the country's debt and all that, ever. No matter who you send to Washington, if they have a system in place that they can't abuse, they will abuse it. On the other hand, if you get rid of this Federal Reserve fiat system and have sound money, it almost doesn't matter who goes to Washington; they can't spend you into oblivion. So
correct.
I implore people, make the money issue your issue. It is the most important one. If you fix that, a lot of the other problems will take care of themselves.
I completely agree, and I think that this nation has plenty of resources, and my wife keeps saying, well, what does it mean when a nation or a city or a county goes bankrupt? They don't close the doors, and she's right. They don't close the doors, but what they do is they use the crisis to advance an agenda, and I'm afraid that's what we're looking at here. And I want people to be prepared as possible, and I think that you've given people some real clarity into the past so they can have a better understanding of the future, Tom. So thanks for joining us today.
All right, thank you, Jack. And I would just ask everybody to check us out at baldyandtheblonde.com, and our show does stream live over the Internet.
Yep, again, that's baldyandtheblonde.com, and the station, if you happen to be in New Orleans, WGSO 990 AM, Wednesdays from 5 to 6, you can listen to them live on the radio or listen to their streaming and past shows, right? You guys have your past shows up on your website as well.
Yeah, we have all of our previous shows, and we've been so fortunate to have just a stellar list of guests. We've had Rand Paul, we've had Ron Paul, Jesse Ventura, Peter Schiff, G. Edward Griffin, Paul Craig Roberts. We've had a lot of... very high-profile people have been, and you've come on, I believe, 3 times.
Correct.
In fact, we set up our own Jack Spirko page. You're so popular on our site. And by the way, I would love to have you back again sometime. I'll get with Michelle, my co-host. We'll figure out what we have coming up, but you're welcome on anytime.
Hey, anytime you guys want me, I'm happy to be there. I love what you guys are doing. And folks, make sure you check out Baldy and the Blonde. .com. With that, I am going to wrap up today. I hope that we've given you some clarity and some insight into some things that seem confusing. They're really not. It's just a shell game, and we are the mark, and it's up to us to know that And it's real easy to not be a mark when you know you're the mark in the first place. It's real easy not to lose at three-card money. You just don't play that game. You put your money in your pocket. You walk down the boardwalk. This is a little more complicated, but it's really not a lot more complicated. You can look around you today, and you know what things actually have value. You know what things people will work for, what things people will want if things fail. That's when you say, where do I put my money? You folks, you got to tailor that to your personal life with your own risk tolerance and your own needs and your own resources. But I can give you the answer. Put it where value lies. And it's easy to see that. Look at a situation where things fall apart and look for the very first things people go to and try to find. That's where your money belongs. With that, this has been Jack Spirico today along with Tom Coates, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough or even if they don't.
Seeing our food these days, you know it's on our TVs.
Well, thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Survival Podcast Friday Flashbacks. If you enjoyed today's show, please consider becoming an MSB member. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more. You can also support our show by going to T-Spaz, that's T-S-P-A-Z, T-Spaz.com. Anytime you shop online, and while you'll support us no matter what you buy, you will find over 500 reviews of items I have personally tested and vouched for. And to stay in touch with us and never miss anything, follow our channel or our group on Telegram. You can find links to that and all our social media options. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and check the show notes for any episode.